Island and having me here. And of course, special thanks to Kelly, Mark, and Adam, and Stephanie, who is not here right now, for making this happen, you know. Yesterday I was here too, but I participated in not that kind of an event, but it was a class, right? Grad class. I was guest lecturing there. Yesterday I talked about the general patterns of, you know, women's employment in Turkey. Today I will be talking about my current research on saleswomen. So it would be a little bit complimentary, but no worries, I won't be repeating anything else. Through this research, my research on saleswomen, I examine gendered organization of or gendered dynamics of immaterial labor in Turkey in the context of globalization. And with this research, I am particularly interested in understanding how, with this, you know, shift from industrial to service economy, we see changes in working class subjectivities and changes in the organization of the labor process. But before going into the details of my research, I would like to tell you a little bit about how I become involved in this particular research, because it is a little bit of a story itself. When I started the grad school in Binghamton more than 10 years ago, I started the grad school in Binghamton in 2005, I was quite interested in this research on feminization of labor. Because what I was thinking is that it would allow me to bring issues of class, gender, and labor together, which were interesting subjects for me. And back then, I was a little bit familiar with the research on feminization of labor done in, you know, Latin American countries and East Asian countries. And those research, you know, have extensively documented that in majority of the export-oriented production or export-oriented industries, you know, there is an increasingly demand for female labor, and women are being substituted for male labor as they provide, you know, a cheap and flexible source of labor. So what I had in mind after having done these readings, I was thinking of writing a dissertation on the feminization of labor with Turkish characteristics, because depending on the cultural and political context, every feminization of labor takes its own route. But then I went on and checked the data, and I found out that in export industries or export-oriented production, there is barely feminization of labor. So it was particularly insubstantial. I mean, there was the shift from policies in the context of globalization, the country shift from import substitution to export-oriented production, and then all the legal changes have been made so that the labor is much more flexible. And then the industrial firms and industrial workplaces increasingly draw on the subcontracting principles. And there were also some women drawn into the labor market. Some of them were working at this, you know, textile sweatshops. Some of them are employed at home working at industrial home workers. But, I mean, all these things did not translate it into a very significant or a wave of feminization in Turkey. But, you know, I was already into this kind of study, and I picked up the subject of industrial home workers, and I carried out research on industrial home workers, female industrial home workers in Istanbul. I mean, in the course of my research, you know, I was just visiting particular neighbors where they are, you know, having a lot of women working at home. And then I was having in-depth interviews with home worker women, or I was observing them while they are doing their work. And towards the end of my research, one day I just wrapped up the interviews and I just left the, you know, neighborhood, and I woke up to the nearest bus station. And it was high summer, you know, it was really hot and humid. It was a terrible August day in Istanbul. And, you know, the bus stop was very crowded. And then you know, there was this young girl, I don't know how I like noticed her, but she was standing right in front of me. She had her headphones on, you know, like she was in black leggings and black t-shirts, like she's definitely a secular young woman. And anyway, I was just, you know, glancing at her, and then she just suddenly collapsed right in front of me. And then everybody helped her, you know, like we just went on, and like people like spilled water over her face. I don't remember, but everybody was like a little bit surprised. Anyway, she recovered very quickly. Apparently, it's a matter of like, you know, she fainted, it was too hot, and she didn't eat anything like a young woman. And just by chance, she and I, we took the same bus and chatted on the way. And, you know, I asked her what she is doing. Like, is she? I thought that, I don't know why, but I mistook her for a student. Apparently, she was not. She told me that she is working at one of the garment workshops. And after I found out that she is working in this workshops, I, you know, started asking her a lot of questions, like, how do you like it? Why did you start working there? And of course, I explained my research to her. And then, she was very, how can I say, I don't want to say, she was she was unhappy about working there. She kind of hated working there. She didn't like the working conditions. She didn't like the working hours. And then I asked her, like, what would you like to do instead? And she told me that she wants to work either at a shopping mall or a hotel or a restaurant. And then when I asked, why would you like to do that? Why do you want to go for this job? And she didn't even like pause for a second. And she said that like the work environment in the shopping malls or in restaurants are completely different than the sweatshops. And there are a lot of people over there whom she can meet and whom she can get along with. So for her, like, you know, she underlined that the environment is something important for her. And then when I look back, like it was 10 years ago, when I look back, I now know that it was the first time that I noticed that for working class women in Turkey, these service jobs have a specific appeal. And they were like willing to take up these jobs. And that, I mean, in the meantime, I finished my work and the field work and the writing up regarding the home worker women. And then I further studied the dynamics of globalization in Turkey. And there I noticed that with this transition from the industrial to service economy, there is actually a feminization of labor going on in Turkey. So it wasn't the export-oriented industries, or it wasn't the export-oriented production, but it was this, you know, the rise of the service economy that kind of initiated the feminization of labor in Turkey. And then, I was like trying to get myself familiarized with the numbers at first, you know. It wasn't just the feminization of the service labor, but this translated into higher labor force participation rates for women. So the service industry has become the largest industry employing women in Turkey. And they, like, I guess, to be exact, I guess service employment account for 48% of women's employment. Then comes the agricultural, that accounts for 35%, and then comes industry, that accounts for the 15% of women's employment in Turkey. So with this, like, you know, with Turkey getting into this global restructuring, integrating itself to, you know, Western markets and European markets, this employment landscape, especially for women, changed drastically. All these places, like the new supermarkets, banks, cafes, hotels, restaurants, have become principal sources of employment for the women. And it wasn't just for the middle-class women, but also for working-class women, these places were providing employment. So I wanted to understand the, you know, these dynamics of the feminization of labor in the service industries. But of course, like, you know, if you want to understand the feminization of labor in relation to service industries, you kind of have to go beyond the industrial paradigm that has, you know, defined the majority of the feminization of labor literature. So that was my thing, you know, I have to like go beyond this existent literature and its theoretical framework. And here I, after I like, you know, have a lot of confusion about the theoretical framework, for those of you who are doing your PhDs, I'm sure you are familiar with this problem too. And anyway, I settled on, you know, this neo-Marxist notion of immaterial labor. And I very liberally draw on Hart and Negri's analysis of immaterial labor. And I also draw on some analysis of the third wave feminists, especially the post-structural feminists, to make sense of the gendered organization of labor and the construction of the self and subjectivity. I mean, with respect to Negri and Hart, you know, like many scholars, because like there are a lot of people who are making research on service labor, which can be considered as immaterial labor in their framework. Negri and Hart draw attention to this fact that, you know, as the societies transform into this post-industrial economies, not only in the nature of labor, but also in the labor process, there are significant changes. First of all, the production of services do not result in the production of like tangible, material, or durable goods, but instead, what we are talking about basically human interactions. So it's a completely different dynamic with respect to the labor and the labor process. Negri and Hart are also particularly interested in this effective labor, which they regard as a subcategory of immaterial labor, and they like draw attention to a variety of ways in which like this effective labor is so much about the human interactions, and it is the human interactions that is one of the essential elements of service work today. So workers are increasingly expected to mobilize their own emotional resources, interpersonal resources, or like communicative skills. And that is one thing, like interaction or emotional resources become something that determine the worker's market value. So it is regarded as a skill right now in the service economy. So they are elaborating on that by talking about the different aspects of effective labor. And also with regard to effective labor, you know, like it is obviously like manipulation of the human interaction and the manipulation of the particular emotions. And when you organize your labor process in this sense, you are creating a particular form of socialities. So work itself, I mean, providing the services goes along with the particular emergence of a particular types of socialities. That was one thing that I had, that I found really interesting while they were talking about that. And there was another thing that also draw my attention. When the people are, you know, draw on their own personality, their own emotional resources to, like, you know, provide the services, the established differences between the public and the private, the personal and the non-personal, or like, you know, the informal and formal, these differences become all blurred, you know, and that also changes our established categories of work and unwork. So that was another interesting point for me to further understand. So anyway, with these, like keeping these in mind, I went on and carried out the fieldwork on saleswomen. And I, like, you know, during these field work, I particularly try to tease out, like, how, for instance, immaterial labor is kind of, like, unfold on the service floor. What were the particularities of immaterial labor, especially it interacts with the culture of that working place. And also I try to understand how the subjectivities are formed in relation to this requirements of the immaterial labor. The reason why I focus on the saleswomen is that when you look at the distribution of female labor in urban Turkey, you see that the sales work is the most common work, accounting for the 23% of the female employment, and it's followed by the professionals, you know. So it was kind of a like, it was a little bit generalizable. It was something that I could just build on. And then I did not focus, I mean, I did not include every saleswoman in my study working in different workplaces. I particularly focused on the saleswomen employed in what I call the new consumption spaces, spaces like, especially new in Turkey, spaces like shopping malls, restaurants, spas, bars, hotels, which have thrived in Turkey over the last three decades in the context of globalization. That's why I call them new consumption spaces. And in these globalized spaces, especially in Turkey, globalized spaces of commerce, the majority of the workforce is female, and they seem to be like drawing on more and more female as a significant source of labor. And I carried out the research in Istanbul. I just looked at the dynamics of the sales work in Istanbul. I employed ethnographic methods. I carried out in-depth interviews with sales workers, both men and women, and I carried out interviews with union leaders, human resource employees, and I also worked as a cashier at a large supermarket in Turkey to get a better understanding of how, you know, the organization of the labor process takes shape in the work settings. And one of the first things that I noticed is that after I start talking to women and after I started working, the first requirement is that, you know, you have to have a high school education. If as a woman you don't have a high school diploma, you are being eliminated at the first stage of the interviews. I mean, you are not even taken into an interview. So that was one thing. All of the women that are working in these new consumption spaces have at least a high school degree. Secondly, I mean, almost all the women were among the first generation in their families to attain a high school education and among the first to be employed outside of the home. So although the men in their family might have education and work outside the home, in terms of the gender and being women, they were the first ones, you know, having the high school education and working outside of the home. And the, another important characteristics were that none of these sales women were wearing headscarves. So they were, you know, they had this secular appearance. And by the way, in Turkey, you know, at least 65 to 70% of women are wearing headscarves. So they constitute the kind of minority here. So my first, hunch, I would say, was to go into the root of understanding why, I mean empirically of course, was go into this root of understanding why these saleswomen have so much similar characteristics in terms of like their appearance, in terms of the education, or in terms of like this being urban. That's why I decided to carry out interviews with the human resource employees, because when you carry out the interviews with the human resource employees, they are really good at explaining their hiring decisions. But when you talk to saleswomen, they are not very clear about why they got hired or something like that. But you know, human resource employees have their own map, have their own categories, so they give you the whole worker subjectivity that they are interested in. But when I, like, you know, when I interviewed with the human resource employees, I not only understand their hiring decisions, but also like the particularities of the immaterial labor operating in the world of sales work. So the first thing that they told me that, you know, they are, not they told me, but they kind of at first implied, and then they started speaking more openly about it. So unlike the industrial employers, the service employers hired explicitly on the basis of appearance, manner, and personality. In the world of academia, we use the, or majority of the scholars use the term aesthetic labor, to refer to these skill requirements. And, you know, with the expansion of the service economy, not just in Turkey, but in many countries, you see that a majority of the workers are being hired on the basis of their racialized, gendered, and ethnicized characteristics as an indicator of these interpersonal skills, or as an indicator of these manner requirements. Okay? And if you, I mean, I'm not going to go into that, but if you want, we can talk about whether this is a kind of disguised discrimination or it is a legitimate practice, because in the literature, it's one of the lines of discussion. And anyway, and it's not just the country-wise, but, you know, in when you look at the different sectors, like, you know, airline, banking, you know, the restaurants, gyms, stores, you see that, you know, the requirements of aesthetic labor is becoming very much prominent and important. So, you know, in those places, employers are screening what Bourdieu calls or defines as habitus, just to make sure that their workers, the ones that hire at least, have the desired styles of walking, standing, you know, even the attitude. It's very important. So with this requirements, like, of course, you know, aesthetic labor is a very generic term and it depends on the cultural context to tease out or to flesh out the particularities of the aesthetic labor. And but in general, we can understand the aesthetic labor as a part of the service employer's strategy to like, you know, get at the, or to reach the particular consumer markets, you know. They are interested in appealing to the cultural tastes of their target consumer markets. And with this reason, most of the time, companies create brand images. You know, there are many companies, they do have their own particular brand images. The supermarket where I worked, they targeted a sort of middle class, upper middle class, secular, educated consumers, and in order to appeal their lifestyle or in order to like their appeal their cultural taste, these employers, and in general, like these majority of employers, develop a brand based on modernity. So they were like providing a modern shopping experience. And of course, a part of these brand image is that they create a workforce who reflect this brand image. So like, if you are a worker, you are expected to embody the kind of modernity they want to project. Or at least, you shouldn't be incompatible with this projected image. So that is how all these brand image filters into the bodies of or the subjectivities of these workers. So in Turkey, the notion of modernity is strictly secularist, meaning that, you know, especially with respect to women, a woman wearing a headscarf wouldn't represent this modern saleswoman all these brands want to project. Okay? So there was this very strong agreement among those employers who wanted to like reach to secular middle class consumers, affluent consumers, that, you know, a woman who is wearing a headscarf is not like the desirable worker for them. So that is one of the reasons why there are no, you know, saleswomen wearing headscarves in those segment of the market. I mean, yes, they were not interested in hiring hijabi women. But on the other hand, you know, this hijab or the practices of hijab, a variety of practices of hijab, is integral to Islam. You know, it is about, it's basically about the religious codes of behavior, integrating personal modesty, and if you are, as a woman, if you are following the hijabi principles, it means that you are gonna also, you know, follow certain things with regard to your clothing and attire, right? And it is part of this Islamic feminine modesty. So although the service employers that I was looking into were not interested in this Islamic feminine modesty, they didn't want to hire that kind of appearance, they had their own notion of modesty too. And they just integrated it into their hiring practices. And women who look to be of questionable morality, that was what one of the human resource employee told me, so I'm just quoting her words, do not get hired. The same human resource employee told me that, and she was really proud by saying that. She said that there was one woman whom she had an interview with, and she immediately rejected her as an applicant because she was wearing red lipstick and painted her fingernails in red. And I just want to read what she said. Just on the basis of this, the human resource employee told me that I did not hire her because these kind of women want to work here only to flirt with customers. It's, their idea of them. There was this very thin line as a woman you have to walk on if you want to get hired in this industries. On the one hand, you are not supposed to be a pious woman who are following the hijabi rules. But on the other hand, you have to be modest. It depends on how you define modest, of course. And in this case, in these service industries case, in the sales work, that means that you are gonna downplay your sexuality in a very specific way. Okay, so that is one thing. But of course, appearance is just one dimension of the immaterial labor. There were also requirements of being open-minded, being extroverted, so you have to keep the conversation flow going. You have to be really comfortable with the mixed gender interactions. So a lot of the interactional skills, especially these ones, are in the context of Turkey embodied in a particular habitus. So you have to be secular, you have to be urban, you wouldn't have any problems with interacting men or a variety of different people. So that, at least in Turkish context, that requires a particular family socialization and a particular type of education. So in order to recruit these women, service employers just tap into a particular segment of the labor market, and they just hired and look into women with, high school degree, urban life, and, secular attitude. So it wasn't any kind of educational credentials they were actually interested in. They just took education as a signifier of the habitus, and that's why they were interested in these group of women. So this whole thing, this is what I call the cultural politics of aesthetics. And it provides a cultural context to immaterial labor, which is actually quite abstract and you need to ground it. When I look through this lens, it helped me to pay attention to the culture, including the Islamic principles, notions of modernity, and other assumptions about the gender, which informed the immaterial labor in the sales work in Turkey. And also, it helped me understand how immaterial labor, depending on the cultural context, relies on different types of subjectivities, the worker subjectivities. So these two, particular types of subjectivity, particular types of cultural norms, and immaterial labor, I kind of understand that all these three are going together in these service work. But in addition to this cultural politics of aesthetics, I also found out that cultural politics of sexuality, I mean, this is my, this is the term I came up with, cultural politics of sexuality is important in understanding the world of sales work. And I use this term, cultural politics of sexuality, to refer to gendered organization of the workplace, you know, which is embedded with the norms and meanings of sexualized behavior, gendered interactions, and even, like, you know, vocabulary that people use at the workplace. I'm going to go into details of that just in a minute. And, you know, when I interviewed with women, or while I was interviewing with women, I noticed that this cultural politics of sexuality has a huge appeal in explaining or in understanding why these women are working there. Because majority of these women, when I interviewed with them and asked, why do you want to work here? What is the appeal of this workplace? They just said that, you know, this workplace is a free workplace. But of course, free, you know, you need to unpack the word free. It's a very generic term and it might mean a lot of things. And when you look at this, you know, this term free or workplace freedom, I later on began to see that it has a lot to do with the cultural politics of sexuality. So when you look at the gendered organization of the work, especially industrial work, in many different regions of the world, you see that the family or kinship or relations, familial relations or kinship relations, come to shape the organization of the industrial work. You know, the patriarchal hierarchies or a variety of different gender hierarchies pervade into the workplace. And majority of the times, you know, I mean, how these patriarchal hierarchies pervade into the workplace. You either, like, use particular types of language, you know, or, like, you know, you kind of shape the interactional behaviors among the customers and the workers or among workers themselves. And that's how all these workplace relations gets, you know, framed into familial or kinship terms. And in the context of Turkey, which has this very conventional gendered division of labor, and it has like a typical strict patriarchal organization, what you see is that especially in the industrial workplaces, men often assume paternalistic attitudes toward women and like discipline these women as if women are their sisters or their wives, instead of like their co-workers. So there is a very clear gender hierarchy going on in the workplace. And a very significant part of this arrangement is the vocabulary. Especially in Turkey, in the industrial workplaces, but not just limited to industrial workplaces, you see that women workers are regularly called bacı. Bacı can be, I mean, we can translate the term as sister, but it also emphasizes women's low kinship status. So it's a kinship term, and it denotes a low status. Okay, this vocabulary is important because with this word you just do a lot of things. First of all, what you do is that, like, men, by calling other women at the workplace bacı or sister, they automatically adopt this paternalistic attitude. But in addition to that, what they do is that they desexualize the relationship between men and women. Because first of all, you know, if you are, even though it is a fictive kinship, if there's a kinship relationship going on, sexuality is a taboo. So you are distancing the sexuality out of your relationship. And also, you know, I talked very little about the hijab and how it is related to Islamic principles. In relation to that, in Islam, there is the seclusion and seclusion practices. And seclusion places restrictions both on women's mobility, but also her interactions with the non-kin men. Okay? So if you're in public interacting with unfamiliar Nankin Man, it is running against the principles of seclusion, and it leaves you in an awkward situation. So here comes the fictive kinship, the term baji, which, you know, labels you as a sister and reframes your relationship with the unfamiliar man in the public. So on the one hand, the term baji or the sister opens up a space for a Muslim pious woman to interact with an unfamiliar man. So this is kind of a liberty that you create for yourself in the public. But on the other hand, the term, the same term, underlines the hierarchy of men and women by placing women automatically to a lower status position. So it's a little bit of a tricky thing. So how does that relate to the sales work? So when I asked saleswomen, why do you think the, you know, sales floor is free? They just told me that because there is no budget talk here. That was what they told me. They told me that because, you know, there was any kind of protectionist, paternalist relationship or any kind of implication of that relationship as we talk to each other. One of the women, saleswomen that I interviewed, told me that I like working here because there is no budget talk here. We call each other by our names. People working here are my co-workers and superiors. So she wasn't the only one. There were a lot of women who were like talking this. And to be honest, when I started my field work, I didn't even expect that this kind of a thing would come up. You know, this is what we call, I guess, grounded theory, right? I did have particular questions in my mind, but I didn't expect this coming. But then, as I just go on and interview with a lot of saleswomen, and they told me the same thing, they were like referring to this term budget, and we are not into this category. And of course, that was something for me, it was a call for me to, you know, change the course of my research. Anyway, so in that sense, a free workplace in the minds of the saleswomen refers to a workplace freed from this paternalistic, protectionist attitude. And for them, the fact that familial hierarchies are flattened was so important. They felt that at least on the workplace, on an interactional level, they are equal with their co-workers, male co-workers. And another important thing is that, they were interacting with men on a non-familial basis, but at the same time, they were able to protect their respectability. So that was another space provided for them. It was something new for them. And I think that represents a shift in the working class culture in Turkey towards more gendered protectionist relationships to more contractual relationships. This was something that wasn't there before the globalization. And remember yesterday we talked about the shame and the stigma on the factory work. That's one of the reasons, you know, people either go for the factory work or don't go for the factory work. And actually, when I talked to women about the factory work, the saleswomen, they told me that if they were to work as a factory worker, they might make much more money than they do on the sales work because, you know, it's the sweatshop conditions and you might work like 18 hours a day if you want to. So you can earn much more money. But they said that the workplace culture or these norms of submissiveness didn't speak to them and they refused to conform to these norms. That's why they don't want to work as, factory workers. Another important dimension of the free workplace for the saleswoman refers to the absence of the sexual harassment. You know, in many countries, in everywhere in the world, sexual harassment is very important issue that we have to address. And in Turkey, it's like that too. And it's a major problem that prevents women from seeking paid employment. So because they think that there is this threat of sexual harassment, they don't even go on the labor market to look for jobs. And one of the research on the unemployed young women showed that women do not even go to job interviews if the workplace is a small one dominated by men. they don't want to work these kind of small, which they tend to see as informal workplaces where there are a lot of men. When we talk about this issue, women did not particularly use the term sexual harassment, but they framed the issue in terms of safety. They told me that, you know, this place was safe, this place was not safe. And at first, of course, I didn't understand what they are saying. I have to, like, ask more questions to understand what they mean by the notion of safety. And later on, I understand that they are actually referring to the sexual harassment. One very young woman said it was her first work. She said that, my father let me work here because this place is not a garment sweatshop. This market is owned by a major corporation. It's a well-known brand. Everybody knows it, and it's safe. Another woman, she was her friend, she said that, what I will say might sound a bit rude, but I must say that guys who work here are not like tough guys with beards who don't know how to behave. But at the garment factories, it's different. If a woman talks to a man, it means that she is making a move. She would immediately be deemed as immoral. So they were basically like, here you see this, like, sexual harassment is kind of very much related to this interactions at the workplace, you know, the type of interactions that women have to go through is very important for them to, you know, go into that direction or not even choose to work. So in that sense, these sales work in these consumption spaces redefines the type of the sociability that we see on the workplaces. First of all, gendered interactions are like, gendered interactions are not deriving from the Islamic or gendered seclusion principles, but they are based on the gender mixing. So that reframes. So that kind of thing reframes the moral context of not only the work but also the interactions. So you and women's, especially women's interactional behavior, is removed from the clutches of this restrictive Islamic norms of, you know, modesty or I don't know how to say, seclusion. So in that sense, I mean, women feel, of course, a little bit free in their own space of work. I'll just, you know, I really like what she said. That's why I included her, you know, account. There was one young woman who worked at a textile factory, and then she quit, and then she kind of, you know, she didn't have the high school diploma, and she went back to school, and she got her high school diploma, and then started working at this market. And this is her account of, you know, how she thinks about the workplace and it's being free. She says that, I felt relieved after I started working here. While I was working at the factory, people would have considered us immoral when we talked to guys. There are strong taboos against close interactions between men and women in the factory. According to people over there, men and women cannot be friends. Men and women might get married and have sex, but cannot be friends. Here I work hard and get very tired, but at least I don't have to watch myself all the time to make sure that I am being moral. So, as a last point, you know, Negri and Hart said that all these immaterial labor creates a particular sociality. And when I looked at the sales floor sociality or sales floor sociability, I said that, you know, they reinforce a new type of sociability based on non-familial relationships, gender mixing, or what we call heterosocial type of relationships instead of homosocial types of relationships. That was common in middle-class workplaces, in professional workplaces, but was not particularly common in working class environments. With the sales work, you see that shift has taken place too, and it is reflected in the increasing rates for women's labor force participation.
All right, thank you very much. So we have